part of the interview with Chuck Whitehead, and the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. The date is January, is it 9th? 10th.
10th.
January 10th.
2000.
Well, Chuck, when we finished last time, we had been talking about some of your activity within Ashland Corporation to assist people who were being discriminated against as employees in the communities that they were working. And you told me a story out of Pensacola, or you told me a story out of Louisiana, and then we moved to a story in Pensacola, and our time and our tape ran out.
Okay.
And do you recall?
Do you recall the story that, yes, I can tell you about in the early 70s, late 60s working with a chemical plant in Pensacola, Florida, where segregation still existed in the early 70s, the plant, in my opinion, was sort of run like a plantation, with the plant manager having the authority to be an absolute dictator, as long as he provided the revenues that the former company had wanted prior to us taking it over, and had did some things in the way of deciding who used the credit union, what they could buy, and what he would approve for them to buy with their own credit union monies and monies of other credit union members. The interesting thing about that whole incident was because of the working conditions and how African Americans was treated. The African American employees, although they belonged to the union, walked out and set up a picket at the plant. And I was called in to see if I could not resolve what the issues. And it was kind of interesting when I got there. I was kind of caught between the devil and deep blue sea, because the union president, international president, had showed up and said that Ashland had a contract with the union, and the African American employees said they weren't going back until some of the issues were resolved. Kind of caught me off guard, but we made the statement that we were only going to review those things where management had prerogatives. We got caught up in a meeting that lasted all afternoon, whereby people wanted to relate to me what had been done in prior years, back in the 30s, late 30s, early in the 40s. And one of the things I said was, well, I can't be held responsible for what happened in the past, but you can hold us accountable and responsible for how we go forward. One of the things the union spoke up and says, well, you can't, they said that we want to go on record of Ashland doing certain things. And I said, you can't go on record in this meeting, because we're only talking about those things that where Ashland management has prerogatives. And so he said, oh. And was quiet. So we went back and agreed to change what was then segregated locker rooms. We also agreed to look at the testing programs that they had at the company, look at the promotional practices and policies that they had at the company, and to change those. And we did, and we changed all of those. But one of the things that we ran in this bathhouse, we had to build a new bath change house in order to tear down the vestiges of the old segregated unit. And I don't know if the plant manager, but somebody in the community or whatever, but they went to the extent of having the health department say that some of the African-American, you know, that quarantine the whole bathhouse so that they didn't have to make the changes right away, because they said that some of the African-American employees were suspected of having TB, which proved not to be the case. It was a stalling tactic that people had used to delay the inevitable, and that was the desegregation of the bathhouses. And I found that to be still in the early 70s, segregation to still exist, even though the law had changed. Old habits are hard to break, and I'd never forget that I go into Alabama to a facility whereby the signs had been taken down, but nothing had changed. And I ended up going out to the hardware store and buying a couple of 2x4s and closing up the old segregated bathhouse and said out of order, off limits, et cetera, in order to force the kind of change that we expected at that time.
What was the union?
Chemical workers. I think it may have been the chemical workers of the union. I can't recall.
Okay.
Chemical atomic unions or something. Or in a lot of our plants in the South, we had the operating engineers. And that was a real experience at working in Texas with them also. And some of the things that that we had to do, particularly when it came to seniority and how seniority was given out, and it was and how some of the African Americans would never would get in line for the better jobs because they were in crafts, or they were in if you started out with janitor, your seniority maybe didn't go into the never could use it in the operating units, or you were had always had low seniority.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I wanted to kind of wrap that up
okay.
in terms of your employment
okay.
with Ashland, if
okay.
we could, and we did just fine. There are actually three areas that I hope we can talk about today. And the first is your involvement with the NAACP. The second is maybe a little bit about your involvement with the Kentucky State University Foundation. And then finally, maybe just a little bit about your interest in education.
Okay.
Does that sound okay? Okay. I have to laugh when I say the NAACP, because we actually tried to do this twice, I noticed, when I went back and listened to the tapes. And each time we kind of just got started, and then we'd move off into, you know, your career in the military or the beginning of your employment in Ashland. But we had lots of good stories, but we never really talked about the NAACP. So I know you said that in Ashland, and I believe in Huntington, there were certainly good people there who later went on to become active at the national level. We talked a little bit about eventually there being a chapter, I believe, in Huntington.
Mm-hmm.
But when did you first decide that you should become a member of the NAACP?
Well, I had been a member of the NAACP prior to moving to Ashland. I was a member in Columbus, Ohio. And the NAACP, there was not a chapter in the Ashland area when I first moved there in 1963, although there was a very active chapter in Huntington, West Virginia, and so the folk in Ashland who wanted needed the help of the NAACP would go to Huntington to get whatever help. But Most of the folk in Ashland, prior to us getting there, I was the first professional to be hired in Ashland. It was one of these small communities where the African-American community was less than 3%. Therefore, people had dual employment. They may have worked in a factory in the day, and they worked in somebody's home in the evenings. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, most of the problems that people would have that they would work through their employer, et cetera. So therefore, as some folks saw it, you know, at the extremes, or nobody really, at during those days, really wanted to rock the boat. And there were people in the community who were very prominent, who could make decisions. As I can, I'll give you an example of that, a story that was related to me by a Reverend George Childs, who was the...
I think you did tell me.
Did I tell you that story?
Right.
Okay, well, I'll move on. And not until I became director of Equal Opportunity Affairs for Ashland and really had an opportunity to start to focus on some of the problems that a community like Ashland might present, and how do, if you wanted to be an agent of change, how do you get those changes made? And one of the things that I thought that we could do, or we should do, that gave people an opportunity to make whatever changes that they felt needed to make, was to have a strong NAACP chapter. And by doing that, one of the things that we did was to take out a corporate membership in the NAACP, and also encouraged our employees to join and to make sure that that we help to finance or made regular donations to them so that they would be active, or they could be active in the community as they, if they so chose to be. And so there probably is the how the first NAACP chapters were came about in the Ashland, Kentucky community. And this was the late 60s, 69, 1970, early 70s, simply because there were these problems of employment, there was problems with housing, et cetera, and therefore nobody really in the community at that point in time wanted to really, rock the boat. And working for a company like Ashland in a small community like that, that gave you certain leverage that we would not have had otherwise to get certain things done, as far as housing was concerned, as far as bringing in new people to the community, and to making sure that that the community was attractive enough in those kinds of ways that would allow us to meet our obligation as a federal contractor, you know, to get somebody to from Cincinnati to move to a place like Ashland, Kentucky would have been a major chore. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we did was to do what we call impact employment. And impact employment means that we brought in maybe 9, 10, 11 families all at one time so that it would make an impact on the community. It would allow them to have a social structure which by they could rely on each other, and would change help change the culture and the atmosphere of the community, because people would interface at a different level than what they had interfaced before. My experience with that community was that people, because they had dual employment, had always made a fairly decent living for themselves, including the African Americans. The issue was, and like a lot of southern areas at the time, was that people were able to educate the children, but if you educate your children there, they had to go elsewhere to find a job. There was no place for them to work in that community. Right. And so therefore, you found a lot of families who had children who were doing well all over the country simply because they were educated at Ohio State, Kentucky State, or University of Kentucky, and had moved on to other places to work.
You're actually telling me about a new kind of membership. I know about youth membership and adult membership, but a corporate membership in the NAACP is more recent than the
right. Well, we bought a corporate life membership, and so rather than saying a corporate membership, we would probably say. You could put it in the category of a corporate life memberships, okay? So you're familiar with the life memberships of the NAACP?
A little bit. Okay. Right. What does that commit the corporation to, basically?
What it is that it gives them the same rights and privileges as any other member of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, as I understand it, you now have moved to be on the national board of the NAACP.
I serve on the national board of the NAACP. I serve on the treasurer of the Special Contributions Fund of the NAACP. I'm on the executive committee of the NAACP National Board, and I chair the largest fundraiser that the NAACP has, which is the Image Awards. How did I get involved at the national level? That was a question that I started to take an interest. As I said before, there were two gentlemen in Huntington, West Virginia, who were very, very active in the NAACP and sort of were my mentors while I was in the Ashland area. One was an attorney by the name of Herbert Henderson, then a minister by the name of Charles Smith. Herbert Henderson later became acting general counsel, had served as general counsel, and Charles Smith came on to be deputy director of the NAACP and served a number of years under Ben Hooks. So therefore, that kind of drew me into the national scene, and what I was doing for Ashland at the time was there came a time when the Special Contributions Fund were trying to get more corporate types to become involved, and apparently because of what I had done in Ashland and in Kentucky became a natural to become part of this. And one of my, let me tell you about my work in Kentucky leading up to that. Most states had conference of branches, statewide organizations, and John Johnson, who serves, works for the national now, was at, I think he was president of the Louisville branch, but he had wanted to find a way of financing and bringing together and providing funds for the state conference of branches in the state of Kentucky. And one, he called a meeting or had one of the other oil companies that were located in Louisville had hosted a lunch for him, and I was at that lunch, and we talked about putting up monies to help finance the state NAACP branches. So we were one of the the original companies to put monies to help finance and to solidify a state conference in the state of Kentucky, and that was in the early 70s. And so therefore we spent a lot of time at doing those kind of things, and we were played a major part in the last national conference that they had, convention that the NAACP had in Louisville, and this is some, I think, 78 or 1988, a number of years ago. And one of the things that we did was, I'll never forget that the year prior to having the conference in Louisville, the conference had been in St. Louis. And it was the year that...
So this was the national conference,
right,
that was being held in Louisville.
Right. Okay. And we... In fact, we probably spent, put up, which was a large amount of money for us to do. We were major sponsors of any number of events at that particular convention, and I put my whole staff to work in helping, making sure that that happened. And it was one of the better conventions that I think that, that the NAACP had had.
Well, I remember a few years ago when I was living in Richmond, Virginia. Richmond was on a short list of potential sites, mm-hmm, for the NAACP conference a couple of years down the road, and I don't think they ever made it. But it was very clear from the news publicity and the conversations going on that, you know, this was a big event, and it was going to require an awful lot of the city's participation to make it happen.
Well, Louisville has a lot of, in my opinion, it's a good convention city. It has lots of hotel rooms. Transportation is not a big requirement because the convention center is downtown. And they've got the trolley that runs up and down the street, so it's a natural. It was a natural for us because there was five or six hotels within walking distance of the convention center. So therefore, Louisville was very, very attractive, and having a major corporation put up the kinds of monies that we put up versus what the rest of the companies in Louisville, which Louisville has a lot of companies that have African Americans as major consumers, as you talk about tobacco, mm-hmm, you talk about alcohol, you talk about fast food, and, mm-hmm, and so some of your biggest clientele, right, are African Americans.
Right.
And so therefore, we that probably started in my involvement with the NAACP. One of the things that I was always interested in was, I am an accountant by education. And so therefore, right away I took an interest in the finances and the internal operations of the organization. And when Merle Evers Williams came to power, and the NAACP was in really bad shape financially. Frank Borges, who had formerly served as the treasurer of the state of Connecticut, and he was treasurer of the NAACP, and I was treasurer of the Special Contributions Fund, and we decided to work in tandem and looking at these two funds to see how we could make the NAACP financially viable once again. From there, I was elected to the national board, and by being on the national board, and also by being the treasurer, the special contributions automatically put me on the executive committee. Now, I spent a couple years in a very, very awkward position, and that was being on the executive committee of the NAACP and not being on the national board.
I see.
And that was pretty awkward from the standpoint of not really having a vote in the regular meetings, but having a vote when the executive committee was in session. The Constitution and bylaws of the NAACP says that the president and the treasurer of the special contributions fund are also members of the executive committee of the NAACP.
Sounds like you go to a lot of meetings. Is that true? Or?
Well, we have, with technology being what it is, the first couple of years was really trying. It was trying from the standpoint that we almost went once or twice a month to Baltimore to do hands-on things, to meet with our funders, the Ford Foundation, as an example, to talk with staff, to talk with vendors, to make sure that it was almost like running it on a day-to-day basis. I probably during that first year, talked to someone in the NAACP every day for the first year, primarily about the finances, how to clear up the finances, and sort of we were able to get the Ford Foundation to provide some funds for Price Waterhouse to become our in-house accounting firm. Which means that after first couple of meetings with the internal staff, we decided to let everybody go on the internal staff except those folk that we really needed for historical purposes. And one of the first conventions that we went to, and that was in February, but we went to the convention that year in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and some reporters. I made a speech before the presidents of the state conference, at the state conference presidents meeting. And one of the things I made a vow and made a pledge to them that we would not leave Minnesota on anybody any money, and that we kept that that vow and that promise.
And that was what year?
That was...
Or just approximately?
Approximately 96, 92, 93, okay. Somewhere.
So this decade, mm-hmm. Last decade.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've been following the boycott in South Carolina. And have noticed that the state NAACP is really sort of leading the charge,
mm-hmm.
there. And wonder if the national NAACP has any role or what their role might be in that.
Well, the national NAACP at its last convention, starting in January, agreed to boycott the state of South Carolina until the flag comes down.
Mm-hmm. The Confederate flag.
The Confederate flag comes down. And which is kind of interesting from the kind of role that I play. I have a friend who has a timeshare at Hilton Head, mm-hmm. and which we normally go to every September, and this year we didn't go simply because of the Confederate flag situation. I think that, and I read a letter the other day about Hilton Head saying that we agree with you, and so therefore maybe you ought to exempt us from the boycott. And we said that you need to work with the state. It's and so we have been, the National has been really instrumental in coming, having a coalition of groups to come together who have supported our efforts in South Carolina. But I was really kind of disheartened a little bit to see over the weekend that there was a rally in opposition to what we wanted, you know, and saying that
I saw that with about 6,000 people.
Saying that. So this goes to show you just how much of a racial divide that we still have in this country.
Right. I was struck with one of the individuals who was interviewed as part of the press who attended this rally, and or several, and they were asked, well, you know, don't you care what the country thinks about South Carolina and what's going on? And they said, no, you know, we just want the Confederate flag to fly as it always has, and just not good situation.
Well, it's kind of sad when I think people really don't understand what's happening in the world, and when we start talking about a global economy and how that affects all of us, and how if we are to maintain a strong America, that we have to be united as a people from the standpoint of the survival for us to maintain a certain standard of living in this country, that the old thinking has to, it just has to change. It has to change, and it will change. Russia changed, and I mean, whoever thought that communism would, whoever thought that apartheid is probably more of an example that apartheid would change. But probably more progressive than part of the North, because there's always been that kind of a different kind of relationship. It's been a kind of open kind of relationship, and there's been this kind of the subtleties of the North have been, in my opinion, more difficult in some cases to overcome. And if you remember the history of Dr. King, that some of his most violent and unexpected moments not came in when he tried to do some things in the North. It was okay as long as those kinds of things took place below the Mason-Dixon line, but it was, nobody wanted him to come North with some of those kind of ideas. And so therefore, in some cases, the South has made a lot of progress, but then you have the those old symbols, signs, etc., such as the Confederate flag, that have been difficult to overcome. And South Carolina is one of the states that that needs to happen. And it is kind of interesting. A few years ago, and I don't remember the years that, but we had one of our board meetings in Columbia, South Carolina, and Brown versus Board of Education. It was during the, the 10th, or maybe not the 10th, but one of the anniversaries.
Anniversaries of the
right, but the case that started on it ended up in Supreme Court as Brown versus Board of Education, but it started in Sumter in South Carolina. So we decided to visit that school while we were there. And I'm saying to myself, I'm not sure I want to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and go out some 50 miles to visit the school. But I was glad that I did. And I could not believe my eyes as to what I witnessed. It was almost as if you had gone into South Africa, in Soweto. The school had been abandoned once the school had been integrated. All the whites went to private schools and left the school there with not very much being done to it over a period of time. But they were in the process of building a new school. To sit there and watch these kids who were so anxious to please us, and they were all scrubbed up and they had little blue and white uniforms on, and they prepared lunch and they prepared a program for us. And it really made my heart feel good, but because of the national attention, all of the county officials had an opportunity to come out. And I had an opportunity to talk to the superintendent of schools. And and I just told her in a very nice way that...
It was a woman.
And about the conditions I saw. And how could she let that superintendent of school. That brought tears to her eyes. And she started crying and told me that she was going to do better. You know, it's from the standpoint that once she saw and she looked, and I knew she knew that that just certain things that happened that should not have happened. And these kids, one or two had made very high, but test scores were absolutely atrocious. I mean, these kids had. Basically, you start talking about going to an institution of higher learning, and this is why I feel so strongly about remedial education. It's not that what our expectations are, or what the expectations of those who have and the have-nots. If you look at, and I am familiar with the school systems in Ohio, and they just passed law, the equalization law. But in southeastern Ohio, we have school districts where $3,000 were spent on a student versus other rich school districts where $15,000 per student per year were spent. But we expected unequal input, but equal outcome. And so therefore, the same thing in Kentucky, that we have to make sure that, we may have somebody who graduate summa cum laude from a school in eastern Kentucky, but has not had the same opportunity and the same exposure as someone from Ohio or from one of the larger school districts. Now, should we deny that individual an opportunity to learn if perhaps they've been deficient in a certain area? And if you go to a place like Eastern Kentucky University or Moorhead, there's no stigma attached to remedial education, simply because everybody, most of the folk go there and need remedial math and remedial English.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about your involvement with the Kentucky State University Foundation.
My involvement with the Kentucky State Foundation came about, once again, in the I played football against Kentucky State for Central State, so I had some knowledge of Kentucky State being a historical black institution, and also that Central State and Kentucky State were big rivalries in athletics and all part of the same conference. But I really didn't get involved Kentucky State until, once again, I worked for Ashland, and we would recruit at Ashland. And Ashland had a really strong ties with Kentucky State. Paul G. Blazer, the founder of Kentucky State, he had a knack of contributing monies to causes that he felt really needed the support. Lee's Junior College in Kentucky and a lot of schools in Eastern Kentucky and Kentucky State University. The library at Kentucky State University is named, it's called Blazer Library, and it's named after the Blazer family. Well, I never forget that during one of my recruiting trips, I was called in by the president, and he wanted to know why I had been coming to Kentucky State University recruiting all of those years and not hired any Kentucky State graduates. And what I told him was, Mr. President, I come to buy apples, and you've been trying to sell me oranges all these years. And he just kind of looked at me and smiled, and he said, will you help me produce some apples? And so that kind of committed me to, and I said I would, committed me to seeing what I could do with my involvement with Kentucky State. One of the things we went back and right away we did was to give Kentucky State, we found that they had more faculty than they had students in the chemical department, the chemistry department. And so therefore we gave created a scholarship program and created a research grant for Kentucky State University, and also allowed some of the excess equipment, et cetera, that we had in some of our laboratories, et cetera, to be given to Kentucky State to strengthen their chemistry department. So right away they went to, I guess from 2 or 3 students to 20, 30, 40 students in chemistry. The second thing that we did at Kentucky State was we came together with the University of Kentucky and created a dual engineering program, what we call a 2+2 or 2+3, whatever they call it. But anyway, it was a program whereby you went 3 years at Kentucky State and 2 years at the University of Kentucky to get a degree in engineering from the University of Kentucky, and you could also pick up a degree in mathematics or applied science or something from Kentucky State University. We funded that program by providing a full-time person to run that and paying for that person at Kentucky State and providing scholarship monies for students who were in the program, and also providing summer job opportunities in engineering for those folk who were a part of that program. And so right away I became a target for the Kentucky State Foundation, and I went on their foundation board. Served on the board for a number of years, not in a leadership role, but as a board member. Then they brought on a young man who had been on the Counselor of Higher Education for the state of Kentucky, who was an attorney by the name of Raymond Burse. And Raymond is a Rhodes Scholar, very, very articulate young man, and I became interested in what he wanted to do at Kentucky State, and so therefore I assumed the role that was elected to chair the Kentucky State Foundation. The Kentucky State Foundation became very, very active, and we did an excellent job. In fact, 1 year we were nationally, we had the largest percentage of givers of any school in the country. We went from like percentage of increase from 3 or 4% of the alumni giving to 18% in less than 2 years. And we built up a foundation that had a couple hundred thousand dollars to a foundation that had over $3 million. Well, and that went on. Raymond was there for about 5 years. And then we got a new governor. Some people who wanted to felt that, in my opinion, that Kentucky State, there was several attempts to close Kentucky State down based on the fact that people felt that African-American students could go to any institution in the state. And therefore, Kentucky State still had a lot of out-of-state students coming there, and that Kentucky could best be served by making Kentucky State a junior college, et cetera. So therefore, when we took up the cause for Kentucky State, because those folk who were advocating that really didn't understand what was going on at Kentucky State. Why did they have so many out-of-state students versus in-state students? One of the reasons were that if you were educated in Kentucky in the 60s or the 70s, there were few job opportunities. And so folk had to leave the state to get jobs. And so therefore, but they had a good experience at Kentucky State. And so if they were Kentuckians, they wanted their children to have that same opportunity, and they would send their children back to Kentucky State. The other thing, too, is that in the higher education environment, I think Kentucky State and historical black colleges played a role in allowing African Americans to at least have a institution where they felt that they were in charge of something. And people really don't understand that African Americans in Kentucky feel that, lots of them feel that the only thing that they own is Kentucky State University. And so therefore, little old ladies in Paris and in Harlan, Kentucky will come to the fence.
I interviewed some of them.
Who will come to the defense of Kentucky State when they won't get involved. Right. When they won't get involved any other way politically in the state.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back a minute, because you raised a very interesting question for me when you talked about increasing alumni giving at Kentucky mm-hmm. State. And just recently I've seen a study of the private colleges today, mm-hmm. and the center, in fact, was identified as being up there at the top of mm-hmm. alumni who mm-hmm. who give to their college. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, of course, private is always, you're going to find a higher level of giving than you are at public generally, but I wonder if that's true with the historically black colleges. Do you have any idea?
Well, it's I would say that giving at historical black colleges have not been that good. I mean, could have been better. It's because
you've got a whole set of circumstances.
Well, the circumstances may be different, but I think that it's a matter of will, and it's a matter of attitude, and it's a matter of having somebody at the helm who has vision. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. United Negro College Fund has got somebody, so they're getting a lot more money than they ever got before. Mm-hmm. Spelman College a few years ago had a, forget the lady's name, but she had some vision, she understood fundraising, and so therefore she got people
Jeanetta to get
Cole, right? Jeanetta Cole got people to give on a large scale. Well, Kentucky State, I think over the years, is no different from some other institutions that we have in the state who, for many years, a large percentage of their budget came from the state. But this has been decreasing every year, and so some folk have gone to the legislators and kind of got what they want, and not really understanding that the president at a modern institution has a sort of different role, that a vast majority of their time has to be spent in the fundraising arena. Raymond understood that. I don't think that we had any president after Raymond who really understood that, because we went to great pains and effort to make sure that Raymond understood. I never forget the conversation that he and I had about getting some monies from a corporation like Exxon, where you don't know anybody at Exxon, and why would Exxon want to give some money in Kentucky, you know, the whole kinds of things. So we go see the people at Exxon and tell them the Kentucky story, and tell them exactly what it is that you want to accomplish and how you're going about doing it. And you're a Rhodes Scholar, and that someday you want to have a Kentucky State produce a Rhodes Scholar. And he goes up there early on in his career as president. They come back and they give him a gift of $50,000, they said. And so, you know, he had lots of success very early in the fundraising game. But historically, it's like, well, sometimes we set the bar too low, and when we have a low bar and low expectations, it gets low results or minimum results. So if you have high expectations, it was always amazing to me about when I would do college recruiting, and I would go to a school like Miami of Ohio or any or University of Kentucky, and the emphasis that they placed on recruiting and the relationship with businesses, and because of their history. Then I would go to a historical black institution, and they would have down in the basement in some hot, stuffy room, you know, and not pay much attention to that activity, and not putting the money into it, and not having somebody of the same caliber of kind of operations as some of the predominantly other schools would. But then you would run into a school whereby somebody understood that. Well, one of the schools early on that I visited, where they had somebody who really understood, that was Southern University in Baton Rouge. They in the director of placements office was next to the president's office, mm-hmm. and the placement office was, you know, was in that same administration, built very nice quarters, and they did a nice job for that institution, Tennessee State University in Nashville. Was another entity that understood what that was all about. Now, the privates probably knew, had more experience in fundraising and knowing what they had to do than the publics.
But I just sense as I talk to people who, older people who have attended Kentucky State, exactly as you say, I mean, there's such loyalty and support for that institution that even though it's a public school, you know, I just feel like they would do whatever they could to help things there. And those who have been there, and most of them have done their education there, you know, just I think it was a wonderful experience.
It was a wonderful experience. If you had come out of southeast Kentucky, a place like Harlan, or if you had come out of Hopkinsville, Kentucky, this was a ticket to get to be respected, to learn a profession, and most of your teachers mm-hmm. per se.
Well, in even Kentucky, Secretary Marlene Helm, who came here from New York, I believe.
And I don't know if Marlene has, you know, if she traces her history back, if she can trace anybody back to ancestors, back to Kentucky. But a lot of the people from out of state have roots in Kentucky. And so therefore, people who have gone to Kentucky State. But one of my experiences was that we were not connected to the school for a number of years. It was kind of a private foundation. And one of the reasons we made a private foundation out of it is that we did not have to adhere to the state investment programs, et cetera. And so therefore, we could grow the foundation much faster. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, then we got into a big argument with the new chair of the board, by the way, which was ex-governor Louis Nunn, and vice chair, ex-governor Ned Breathitt, as to whether or not that we were private or a public foundation. And this is...
Louis Nunn was the chair of the KSU board?
Yes.
And Ned Breathitt
was the vice chair.
Vice chair.
Okay.
That must have been an interesting period.
you believe me. So we get into this big legal battle with the board of trustees, and it's still some vestiges of that now as to whether or not we were private or public. In this case, goes all the way to the Kentucky Supreme Court, of which it was kind of a Solomon kind of decision, which said that we were up until a point, and after that point, we were not a public concern, a private concern. We were operating really on. Properly on the way we were doing things. So I think the state invested in bonds, et cetera, and their return was like 4%. They were getting as much as 18-25% return on our investment. Hiller and Lyons always handled our investments and did a really good job for us, and continue to do a good job for that foundation. So that's primarily my involvement with Kentucky State.
I hear over and over in some way the importance of education to you and your career, and as I understand it, the foundation that you have become the president, is that mm-hmm. your title?
That's correct.
It focuses heavily on education.
Right.
And certainly your activities at Kentucky State, and more recently, now you're the chair of the board at the new Council for Postsecondary Education. Education just runs throughout your life as being an important area of advocacy and interest for you. Would you just talk about that a little bit with me?
Education changes lives. It's the one thing that I think that that provides equalization, the real equalization in this country. It allows a youngster, a man who was born in the Piney Woods of Mississippi, to get where he is today. It had to be because of education. My parents, while they may not have been able to articulate what makes this country work, but they really understood our economic system. And they knew that our economic system was based upon, took two things, and they were joined together. Education and economics, if you wanted to get ahead in and being able to compete. And they understood that the free enterprise system meant competition. And so one of the things that they observed by being sharecroppers in Mississippi, that you needed two things, that land was wealth, that education was power, and it allowed you to create wealth. It allowed you to get ahead in this country. And they knew this by observation. Two things my father said to me as a youngster: get as much education as you can and own some land. And those were Southern virtues that when they had the big migration from the South, that was taught, was told to us. And so therefore I was the first in my family to have an opportunity to get a college education. And what I did in college was dependent on what the rest of, not only just my family, but the family unit would have had an opportunity to do. And we still have what we consider to be head of our family, and that the head of the family, and I don't know if we got this, where we picked up this trait, but the head of the family still visits sick. He knows where all the family members are. He's got everybody's addresses, and so therefore, I never forget that my father and his brothers came together to talk about me going off to college, and of course that summer I had a very, very good job working over the summer, and they, better jobs than any of them had, but as a part-time job, which I could have stayed at, and they were just, questioned You know, what good would an education do when he's already got this good job? He probably needs to go to work. It's kind of interesting. My cousins told me later that when I would come home for the holidays, and they would always want to know when I was going back to school. And they said, now, it's not that we didn't want you to stay and have a good time. We wanted to make sure that you went back to school and did what you were supposed to, because if you had messed up, then you would may have ruined our chances of getting a mm-hmm. college education. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, we sat down, now we talk about that. Mm-hmm. But if you take a look at you know, all of the sacrifices that some of those families made at that particular point in time to try to get their children education, and we were very, very, you know, my generation was very, very serious about getting an education. And as I look back and saw that we were still a very, very small unit of people that in 1961, when I graduated from college, there were like only 55,000 African Americans in college mm-hmm. In the United States. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
Huh?
And what's the number today?
I don't know what the number is today, but 55,000. And so therefore, it was a small world, and you probably knew everybody that, if you talked to anybody long enough, you knew everybody, every African American who had a degree, mm-hmm. no matter where you went. You know, you run into some people and you say, well, you're from the state of Washington. And you say, well, yeah, you know so-and-so. Mm-hmm. Quite naturally, they knew that person. But it's, so therefore, and I've seen the power of education, and I know that education is what's going to help the state of Kentucky. Education is what's going to have to happen in a knowledge-based society to lift up this state. I just don't see how we don't have, in a global economy, we don't have any choice but to support education. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is that we have to lift all boats. And I never forget hearing, as a young man, somebody give a speech, and I never forgot this piece of the speech. He says to me and to this audience, what good does it do any of us to be on a yacht with a blue blazer on and a pair of gray slacks, and you got a hole in your bow? Doesn't do much for us, does it?
Right.
And so therefore, I think that we have to take a look at how do we raise the playing field and improve the lives of all Kentuckians. And Gordon and I have had these kind of conversations. You know, people keep talking about how will you know if we have succeeded? Well, I think we know if it's the evidence will be very obvious that we will attract the kind of jobs to the state whereby our citizens can make a living. I'm not talking about getting a job, but I'm talking about making a living wage where they can take care of their families and have some of the things that other people have in this country, you know.
Well, I've come to the end of the questions I wanted
okay.
to ask you. I wonder if there's anything, though, that we haven't talked about that you'd like to include in this interview.
Well, I'd like to conclude this by saying that I've seen some evidence of people trying to push the clock back. But I have hope. I have a vision, and I have dreams, and I recognize that it doesn't do anybody any good to have a yacht with a hole in its bow. And therefore, we have to make sure that we raise the level of everybody in this country. And I think education is the way that we do this, that make this the viable economy that we need. We need everybody in this economy to not be a drag on the economy, and to be able to be pay taxes and to do those things that makes this a better country. You know, I don't believe in the old trickle down theory. You know, we tried that once and it never got down to where it needed to be. What we find is that some of the public schools, et cetera, and I'm not so sure that all of the new gimmicks that we come up with it helps raise all boats. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a way of taking care of somebody else's problems, mm-hmm. but it doesn't really, what we've got to do is have the will to go back into the public institutions and fix it. We can. I mean, if we can put a man on the moon, or then we can fix education, and if we have the will to do it. I was telling the people here across the river, and they were talking about you know, all the problems that they had with the inner city schools, et cetera, which used to be. And I'm saying the reason you have a problem is because nobody has the will to fix it. And once you decide that you have the will to fix it, it'll get fixed. And it'll get fixed in a hurry. Mm-hmm. It's like the story I told you about the preacher, how integration occurred in Ashland. It occurred overnight because somebody had the will to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wonderful metaphor of the yacht. We're hosting a 3-day conference in February on the whole Kentucky experience with civil rights. And I just finished putting the program together, sending it to the printer, and I wish I'd actually, I went back through some of the early interviews that I've done, mm-hmm. and have had transcribed and pulled out little quotes from people. And I wish I'd had that metaphor of your boat at the time, that I could have included it in the program, but I'll use that.
Well,
again,
this is the kind of thing that you got your tape off now. Got your tape off.